Good morning. Welcome to Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. In this first hour, we'll be talking about the NSA, the National Security Agency. It is the largest, most costly, most technologically sophisticated spy organization in the world. And our guest this morning is someone who I'm sure more than any other journalist has done more to shine some light on the NSA and to talk about just what it is and how it's structured and what it does. And our guest is James Bamford. He's the best-selling author of Body of Secrets, The Puzzle Palace, and Pretext for War. The Puzzle Palace was his first book that was published in 1982, and it was the first book ever published about the National Security Agency. He researched it using the Freedom of Information Act, and at that time, the NSA tried to prevent the book from being published. But it was, and he has now gone on to continue to write about the NSA, and as I say, probably be the leading authority in this country about the NSA. His most recent book, the one that's just out, is titled The Shadow Factory. The subtitle is The Ultra-Secret NSA from 9/11 to the Eavesdropping of America, and Eavesdropping on America. And what he does here in the book is essentially look at two things. Look at what NSA was doing immediately before 9/11 and how it responded to 9/11. Looking at the fact that the agency, he argues the agency, missed a chance to stop two of the 9/11 hijackers once they were known to be inside the United States, and then as an overreaction, perhaps, to the attacks, worked to try to prevent further attacks by listening in on the conversations of many, many Americans, and most of them, maybe almost all of them, without any indication that they themselves personally were involved in terrorism. He's joining us by phone. Questions certainly are welcome. 333-9455 is the number here in Champaign-Urbana, and toll-free, 800-222-9455. At any point here, you're certainly welcome to give us a call and join in the conversation. The only thing we ask of callers is that people just try to be brief in their comments so we can keep things moving along, getting as many callers as possible, but certainly anyone's welcome to call. Mr. Bamford, hello.
Hi, David.
Thanks very much for talking with us.
My pleasure.
Just to start, maybe we should just ask you to give us the thumbnail sketch of the NSA. There may still be people, I expect, listening to us that aren't really quite sure what the NSA is and what it does.
Well, I wouldn't be surprised. There's been hundreds of books written on the CIA, much more well-known intelligence agency, but there's only been three written on NSA, and I wrote all three. So there's very little information that the public really has on NSA because it is the most secret agency in the U.S. And what makes it different from the CIA is the CIA does the traditional James Bond type of intelligence collection, sending agents out trying to recruit new agents, stealing secrets, hiding bags of documents behind trees, that kind of thing. What NSA does is eavesdrop on communications. It eavesdrops on telephone calls, email, web searches, any kind of information that goes through the air, goes through a wire. That's what NSA is interested in. Hmm. And NSA has focused on a tremendous amount of U.S. communications in the last few years, and that's what's that was one of the focuses of my new book.
And that the reason that is important is that it's supposed to be the case that they're not, that the intelligence gathering that they're doing, that they're listening into communications outside of the United States. This was not supposed, they were not supposed to be eavesdropping on Americans in America.
Well, NSA's job is to try to find people that can harm us overseas. It's the FBI's job to deal with eavesdropping in the United States, and they go through a warrant procedure and various legal procedures to do that. The NSA, which is far more powerful and eavesdrops on just millions and millions of communications an hour, is supposed to do that overseas, just like we don't have the Army patrolling the streets in the U.S. We don't have the NSA eavesdropping on everybody's phone call in the United States. It's something we use overseas against enemies and against people who are seeking to harm us overseas. And that's the way it's always been with NSA. It spent most of its life since 1952 listening to the Soviet Union to prevent a surprise attack, and this is very different, trying to go after terrorists.
I mentioned the fact that you had written this book, The Puzzle Palace, and at that time, NSA tried to stop the book from being published. When you wrote your second book, and we talked about this, the curious thing at that time was that here we were in a period where it was after the Cold War, and the budget for intelligence was shrinking. And at that time, NSA was actually interested in getting some attention for what they were doing because they were concerned about maintaining some kind of base of support for their operations. But it seems that also what's happened in the period, say, between the end of the Cold War and 9/11 is that also at NSA, there was this particular concern with not getting anybody upset. I mean, they didn't want to get into trouble. They had gotten into trouble before, and perhaps for that reason then they, as the argument I think you're making in the book is that they never really went beyond the minimum that was required of them because they were afraid that if they did too much, that they would get into trouble.
Well, that's right. As you mentioned, the NSA threatened me twice with prosecution for my first book, The Puzzle Palace, even though I never worked for the NSA. I was just a journalist, a writer. But on the sequel to that book, which came out in May of 2001, Body of Secrets, NSA actually had a book signing for me at NSA, so it's gone between a threatening prosecution and having book signings for me. So I've had a long relationship with NSA, and one thing I found when I did write the sequel, Body of Secrets, was that NSA did follow the law. They had been very closely obeying the law and making sure that there was no domestic eavesdropping. But what I found out in my new book, in the book that just came out, The Shadow Factory, was that NSA went way too far in terms of its keeping away from eavesdropping on America. It has the right to eavesdrop on terrorists in the United States or suspected terrorists. All it has to do is get a warrant from this court, the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court, which is very easy. In 30 years, issued over 20,000 warrants and only turned down less than three or four. So the problem was after, in the 2 years leading up to 9/11, there were two of the lead terrorists had come to the United States. They arrived in January of 2000. NSA was actually listening to their conversations as they were talking to Osama bin Laden's command center back in Yemen. And even though they were listening to their conversations for close to 2 years while they were in the U.S., NSA never bothered to try to get a warrant to target their communications, all their communications. They never notified the FBI. They never notified the CIA where they were. And the ultimate insult came when the terrorists actually set up their final base of operations almost across the street from NSA. Across the Baltimore Washington Parkway. So here you have the NSA eavesdroppers searching for terrorists, basically living side by side with the terrorists themselves in the same town. They went to the same restaurants, went to the same Safeway, they exercised at the same gym, Gold's Gym, and so forth. And when they went to attack the Pentagon, they drove away from Laurel, Maryland, and that's the first time NSA ever heard of them was when the attacks of 9/11 took place. But here they were living with them for a month up until that time, and NSA was eavesdropping on their communications.
Well, obviously, here the question is: since the NSA was eavesdropping on their communications, they had some reason, perhaps, to be suspicious. They knew that there was this connection to Bin Laden. Why is it that NSA never went further? Never gave that information to the FBI to say, "Hey, there's something here. Maybe we ought to look into it." Why is it that they just sat on it?
Well, I think there's two reasons. One of them, as you mentioned, NSA was very gun-shy of doing anything that reflected them eavesdropping within the United States. in the mid-70s, the former director of NSA at the time, or the director of NSA at the time, back in the mid-70s, Lew Allen, an Air Force general, was called before the Senate Intelligence Committee, led by Senator Frank Church, and grilled as to why the NSA had engaged in domestic eavesdropping, which it had done for at that point close to 30 years. That was the darkest day in NSA's history. And that left a lasting impression. And I think General Hayden, who was director in the time leading up to 9/11 and then after 9/11, had nightmares of being called before a Senate committee and being grilled as to why they were eavesdropping in the U.S. So he overreacted. He instead of doing the proper thing, which would have been just to simply get a warrant, would have been very easy, showing these guys had been sent here from bin Laden's operations center, and then begin eavesdropping on their conversations, which then would have led them to all the other terrorists. They just did nothing. They simply listened to the calls and did almost nothing with them. I interviewed the former head of the CIA's bin Laden unit, the person who was basically in charge of the CIA to try to find bin Laden. And he kept trying and trying and trying to get NSA to give the CIA and his unit the intercepts, the transcripts of the intercepts of the people communicating to and from bin Laden's operations center, which would have included the conversations of these terrorists in the U.S. And they refused to do it. They continually refused to do it. And it got so bad that the CIA actually went out and built their own listening post in the Indian Ocean area. I think it was probably on Madagascar, where they began trying to target that, those same communications. And they pulled in, they did begin pulling in those conversations because their technology wasn't as sophisticated as NSA. They were only getting one half of the conversations, just one side of the conversations. So they went back to NSA and they said, well, now we're able to get full transcripts of half the conversations. Can you give us the other half? And they still refused to give it to the CIA. So this is the problem. He had a problem of being too overly cautious, too risk-averse prior to 9/11 in terms of the eavesdropping on the terrorists in the U.S., and then also the turf battle of failure to share this information with other agencies, especially the CIA and the FBI. Hmm.
You certainly would think that as far as they're listening into the conversations of these men would be concerned that they would have been able to make the case that this was not just a capricious eavesdropping on any American, that this was someone who, in the parlance of law enforcement, would be a person of interest, that there would be a reason they could certainly justify doing that, why they didn't take that. I understand the atmosphere there, perhaps, and that is the answer. But you would think that it would not have been that difficult for them to justify, in fact, doing that with these particular people.
Well, it wouldn't have been difficult at all because they were eavesdropping on bin Laden's operations center, which was in Yemen. It was a house in Yemen, which. I eventually went to and saw the location where a lot of this stuff took place. This was a house in Yemen. NSA had been listening to it for 3 years. They heard the message sending these guys to a terrorist summit meeting in Kuala Lumpur, and then a week or so later they show up in California and they're calling back and forth to that same operations center. I mean, it would have been the easiest thing in the world to go to the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court and say these people were directed, to the United States by Osama bin Laden's operations center. I mean, one of the people, Khalid al-Midar, one of the 9/11 terrorists, was actually married to the person who ran bin Laden's operations center, and that's where he lived. He actually lived in the house that was being used as bin Laden's operations center. It would have been the easiest thing in the world to get warrants to eavesdrop on their communications. And what should have happened was immediately when they picked up their conversations in the United States, and technologically it would boggle my mind that they wouldn't be able to determine that they're in the United States, since, you know, with a $50 cell phone, you can tell where somebody's calling you from, and this is an $8 billion agency whose whole purpose is finding telephone calls. That they should have immediately notified the CIA, which would have begun more of an investigation overseas, and the FBI, which then could have tapped their domestic communications. And eavesdropping on those communications, they could have then heard all the conversations between the terrorists talking among themselves within the U.S., which I would have thought would have been a major deterrent, if not a complete elimination of the terrorist threat when they came here.
So is there anybody that would be in a position to say, in fact, if they had done that, and if they had a record of all of their phone conversations and their emails and so forth, that there would have been enough information there to have gotten on to the plans for 9/11? Is that just, are we saying we think that probably would have been the case, or is there somebody who really says, well, yeah, you know, I'm pretty sure, I know that if we had really been able to do that, we could have done something about this before it happened?
Well, there's a lot of people that I interviewed that basically said that, including the staff director of the joint 9/11 congressional investigation. This was the investigation that took place before the 9/11 Commission and was actually far better. The 9/11 Commission, when they looked into this, astonishingly, never looked at NSA's role. I mean, this whole commission was set up, and they were too lazy to go up to NSA. This is coming from people within the committee of the 9/11 Commission. And so they were too lazy to go up to NSA, which was 20 miles away from Washington, to look through the records. So somebody actually got the records and brought them down to a building just a few blocks away from the where the commission staff and the commissioners were doing their investigation, and still they never went over there to look at them. So you have that entire 9/11 commission report that looks basically only at the CIA and never once really looks at the NSA. But the prior commission, the joint congressional investigation into 9/11, did haul NSA Director Hayden in front of them, and although most of it was classified and still secret, I was able to find out what a lot of things that went on, and General Hayden basically said, look, if anything that dealt with the United States, he considered it the FBI's jurisdiction, not his. The problem the commission, the joint congressional investigation came up with was the fact that NSA had never told the FBI. I mean, it's fine if General Hayden wants the FBI to do it, but before they can do it, you've got to tell them about it, and that was the problem. NSA never told the FBI that these guys were in the United States, or obviously they would have begun investigating him immediately.
Just to ask a question about where we are now with interagency cooperation. After 9/11, there was a lot of talk about this being a problem, the fact that NSA, FBI, CIA did not work well together, were not willing to share information, and so we had this reorganization of intelligence, and now we have a director of national intelligence who's supposed to oversee everything, and everybody says, okay, now we're going to play well together. I wonder, do you think that there is evidence, there's reason to believe that since 9/11 that these agencies have dealt with this turf issue, that they are willing to work with one another, that they are willing to share information?
Well, I think it's definitely improved. Yeah, the NSA certainly is more of a team player now within the intelligence community than it was before. But there still are some turf issues related to it, some of it is just sort of natural because you do want some competition between these agencies. I mean, that sort of drives them to do a better job. The point is you have to find the happy medium where they're not competing to the point where they're hiding information from each other. They're working as a team, but they still have to, have a sort of a spirit where the people with the earphones are hoping to do a better job than the people with the trench coats or whatever. So you got to find a happy medium between the two, since these are two very, very different types of intelligence collection. It's just in the end, you've all got to get together and win as a team.
We are just about at a midpoint of this part of Focus 580, and let me introduce again our guests for anyone who might have just tuned in the last 5 or 10 minutes. James Bamford, he's the best-selling author of Body of Secrets, The Puzzle Palace, and The Shadow Factory. These are his three books on the NSA. They're the only books on the NSA. The first one was written back in 1982. That was The Puzzle Palace. His newest is just out. That's The Shadow Factory, the subtitle, The Ultra-Secret NSA from 9/11 to the Eavesdropping on America. The book is published by Doubleday. You can certainly find it in the bookstore now. He has written about national security for the New York Times, the New York Times Magazine, The Atlantic, Harper's, Rolling Stone, other publications. He also writes and produces television documentaries for the PBS series Nova. He is taught at University of California, Berkeley, and makes his home in Washington and in London. And he is joining us this morning by telephone. Again, a question certainly I welcome, 333-9455. Toll-free 800-222-9455. I know that I have read that when the story broke, when the New York Times broke this story about the warrantless NSA being involved in the warrantless surveillance, this was in mid-December 2005, I think I read an interview where you said because you were the kind of the go-to guy on the NSA, and reporters started calling you, your phone started going crazy because they were looking for someone who knew something about the NSA, and that you were as surprised as anyone about this because as far as you knew, your understanding was that in its activities, the NSA was following the law. And you were really the comment here in the story that's in the Times was that you said you were shocked.
Well, I certainly was shocked, yeah. As you mentioned, I am sort of the world's expert on this agency, having written the only three books on it. And I had continuously said when people interviewed me that NSA was obeying the law. They realized the mistakes they made in the 60s and 70s, and they corrected them following the Church Committee investigations in the mid 70s. And from then on, they've been very careful about following the law. I even went to Brussels at one point to defend NSA, which I thought was being erroneously accused of eavesdropping on European business communications and then passing that information on to U.S. companies like General Motors or Boeing or something. So I became very, not only shocked, but very disappointed and also angry at the fact that the agency had disabused its privilege. I mean, it's given this privilege to hide behind this huge wall of secrecy. And it's given that, assuming that they're going to obey the law, and they didn't do that, and that made me very angry. So when the ACLU, American Civil Liberties Union, came along asking if I joined their lawsuit against NSA to try to prevent them from doing this, or at least have a court rule on it, I agreed and became a plaintiff against NSA. So you know, I've had this... I mentioned this very odd relationship with NSA. They threatened me with prosecution after my first book. They had a book signing for me after my second book, and then I ended up being a plaintiff against them in an ACLU lawsuit. And now I have this new book that sort of looks at that whole time period and how it came to be the way it is, and looking into the role NSA is playing in terms of eavesdropping on U.S. citizens without any warrants.
Well, let's talk with... We have a caller here to bring into the conversation. Let's do that. The number, by the way, if you're here in Champaign-Urbana, 333 800-259-9455. We also have a toll-free line, good anywhere that you can hear us. That's 800-222-9455. At any point here, you have questions, you can give us a call. We'll start out here with a caller in Champaign County, here where we are. This is line one. Hello.
Hi. I'm very pleased to have an opportunity to speak with you. There's so many things that you could touch on. The riveting story of the hijackers could dominate the whole conversation, but I know there's so much more you can speak with. One thing I'd like to point out is that around the world, NSA was known for quite a while, and there's quite a bit of activism. Since you spent some time in England, you know about the activism against the listening station and Men with Hill, which is worthy of note, it seems to me. But I wanted to bring it back to this, to Urbana campus again, because SAIC has a facility here, and from other books, Spies for Hire notably, we know that SAIC is the biggest contractor with NSA, and that NSA is it's the biggest single contractor they use as well. So they have a lot going on. Your name came up with in an earlier show this week in discussion about your allegations about Israeli involvement in snooping, and we also have Amdocs in town, which has been alleged by not many. In fact, Fox News, curiously enough, had one of the reports on it in the early 2000s, and it's no longer available from their website archive, which is curious. But the U of I, from your first book, has a connection, too, because isn't it true that NSA was sort of outed by some Russian scholars who defected in the mid-50s, if I'm recollecting correct. I know I've laid a lot out there, as usual, but I just wanted to expand your sure. discourse a bit. Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, thanks for the question. The issues you bring up are all very important. The first one was the connection between NSA and SAIC, a big defense contractor. One of the more amazing things that I discovered this time in doing this book was how much of NSA's enormously secret work, their eavesdropping, is being outsourced to private companies these days, including SAIC. I've been to NSA headquarters many times. It's this huge city of about 50 buildings that are all hidden away from the highway and surrounded by numerous fences with barbed wire and anti-truck devices and anti-tank devices and so forth. But what I found new this time was that there's this sort of annex to the city being built across the highway. It's this enormous complex of buildings that are all owned by defense contractors like Booz Allen, SAIC, Northrop Grumman, Titan, and so forth. And these are all the contractors doing work for NSA. And they actually put ads in newspapers asking for people with prior NSA or military experience to come to work for them and doing the eavesdropping for NSA. So it's NSA's outsourcing has become enormous, and so you have these private companies all over the country. Some are well known, and some are sort of almost fly by night. They're very small companies that that do this. So that takes all that more accountability away from NSA and makes it almost impossible for Congress to sort of keep up with who's doing what, listening where, and it also gets much more expensive. So these contractors are really a major player in the NSA's eavesdropping world these days. In terms of the what I found was that the one of the things that actually astonished me quite a bit was the fact that when NSA is doing this domestic eavesdropping, what they've done is they've hardwired their system into the entire U.S. telecommunication system. So the way way they've done it was by building these secret rooms inside major telecom switches, like AT&T's big 10-story building in downtown San Francisco. They actually have a secret room in there with no one can enter except for one or two people that have high security clearances. And that's where all the domestic, international and domestic communications is siphoned off and filtered through NSA's eavesdropping equipment. And what's surprising was that the actual equipment being used and the software is made by private companies. Again, private companies that are involved in this, and I think that's very worrisome when you have companies nobody have ever heard of acting as the tapping mechanism for virtually the entire U.S. telecommunications system.
And that is still going on in spite of the concerns about what has happened to date and whether or not that's been done in according to the law.
Well, it's not only still being done. It was basically given congressional approval last summer when they created these Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act amendments, these FISA amendments that they passed. The House of Representatives fought it for a number of months from February until July and then gave in July because the election was coming up, and I think they were afraid of being accused by their opponents of being weak on terrorism. So, you know, the result is that it's still going on, and now it has the sort of imprimatur of legality.
I want to go on to another caller here. I guess maybe I'll just give the caller a quick, if you want to do a quick follow-up before I go on.
I guess I could say the question about Amdocs, and it was said that your allegations were debunked just this past couple of days ago on the radio. I don't know what your... I haven't seen...
Well, I don't write about Amdocs in the book, so I'm not sure what was being talked about.
Well, it was just the idea...
I write about two other companies that do this. One is called Naris, and the other is called Verint. And those are the two companies that act as intermediaries. And both companies were formed by Israelis. It was basically an Israeli company was what Verint was. And Naris was also formed by Israelis. And, you know, you have a question of these are the companies that are hardwiring NSA to the U.S. telecommunications system. And yet there's so very little that's known about them, including, you know, what are their origins, where they come from, and what are their connections to foreign governments. All these things are important for the public to know since their communications are passing through their hardware and their software. Those are very important questions that have to be answered.
I thank the caller. I want to go on here to someone else. This is line number two. It's in Champaign. Hello.
Good morning.
Mm-hmm.
You're saying 9/11 was a failure of intelligence, but can you explain to me, you know, who generated the August 2001 PDB stating that bin Laden was going to determine to strike the U.S. and might use airplanes to do it? I mean, where did that come from? And I'll take my answer offline.
Well, that was generated by the CIA. The CIA came up with the PDB, the President's Daily Brief. That's the document that's given to the President every morning and that he's briefed on by the CIA. And that was generated because all through the summer to some degree, even before that, there were these indications that were coming in that bin Laden was going to do another attack. The most important indication was that in, I think it was in June, either late May or early June, he called in a reporter from an Arabic television program. It was based in England. I think it was called Middle East Broadcasting Company. And they basically laid out for the reporter who went to the Afghanistan and met with bin Laden and his associates that there was going to be another attack. Without actually saying that, they indicated something bad was going to happen fairly soon. And as soon as that report was released, all kinds of communications began flowing around the Middle East indicating something was going to happen, and that's when all this chatter, they call it chatter, it's what NSA picks up, and it's the eavesdropping, all this chatter took place. And a lot of that chatter was attack is going to happen soon. So that got a lot of people in the intelligence community, NSA, CIA, and so forth, very nervous that an attack was coming, and that was one of the things reflected in that PDB, which was either July or August, I think it was early August when President Bush was given that PDB.
Well, we have about 15 minutes left in this part of Focus 580. Our guest is journalist James Bamford. He has authored three books about the NSA, the National Security Agency, the only books that there are, starting with his first, that was The Puzzle Palace. It was 1982. Then came Body of Secrets, and his most recent is The Shadow Factory. The subtitle is The Ultra-Secret NSA from 9/11 to the Eavesdropping on America. It's just out fairly recently here, and it's published by Doubleday. Questions welcome, 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. I wonder if you could ask you to talk a little bit more about what happened at NSA right at 9/11, because you explained earlier that before that there was this very risk-averse kind of way of thinking in the agency, and that was they didn't want it widely known that they were eavesdropping on Americans, and for that reason they didn't act on or didn't pass on this information that they had about two people who turned out to be involved in 9/11, who were connected to bin Laden, the fact that they were in the United States. And then there was at 9/11 this wild swing of the pendulum almost to the other extreme. That's what you're arguing, into the other extreme. And that Mr. Hayden, who was at that time head of NSA, had a lot to do with that. What happened there right at that moment? And was it, you really think, from the very top that this change in direction came?
Well, there were a number of factors that led to that. First of all, right after 9/11, General Hayden was the head of NSA. Had to be extremely chagrined at what had happened because he knew the names of the two hijackers, original hijackers who came to the United States, Cledal Midar and Nawaf al-Hazmi. They had been in the NSA's computer for several years at that point, and by then, by two weeks or so before 9/11, two or three weeks before 9/11, the FBI finally learned that they were in the United States after the CIA finally told them after all these years. At that point, they knew that they were in the United States, and NSA was looking for them and realized that they had been picking up their communications all along. So here after 9/11, NSA realizes the people who did it were people that were not only in their database, were people that they had been eavesdropping on. So it was an extremely embarrassing and difficult position for General Hayden. Right at that time is when Vice President Cheney came along and said NSA needs to expand its capabilities to begin eavesdropping on Americans. And Hayden said, well, you know, there's a problem here because the law says we have to get a warrant from the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court. That was quickly brushed aside, and Hayden agreed to the plan to begin eavesdropping on U.S. citizens without getting warrants from the FISA court. The idea had originally, I think, come from Cheney, possibly, and David Addington, his assistant, and was quickly agreed to by General Hayden, who didn't show very much backbone in terms of standing up when he knew what the law said and what was being proposed. On the other hand, there are people that did have a strong backbone on this whole issue. That was, first of all, Attorney General Ashcroft and his deputy, Jim Comey, the deputy attorney general, as well as the director of the FBI. They all, Bob Mueller, who's head of the FBI, they all threatened to resign when they discovered what NSA was doing. And they came within a day of resigning, and they finally got the White House to back down on some of these things that it was doing. And so they agreed to stay on. But they all came, really, I think they had actually written out their letters of resignation because of what was going on. Mm. Yet General Hayden certainly didn't put up a fight and agreed to it all along. I would have much preferred him doing the same thing when it was proposed by Cheney and Addington that the NSA do this. In other words, revert back to the old days of the 60s and 70s. Standing up and say, we've got intelligence reforms and we could do our work just as well by going through the court as by going around the court. I mean, one of the most important factors here is that they didn't need all these capabilities to eavesdrop on U.S. citizens to stop the 9/11 hijackers. They had every power they needed prior to 9/11. The problem was NSA just didn't use them. So it's not a question of not having enough eavesdropping authority or not having enough eavesdropping capability. They had every capability and authority they needed prior to 9/11. They just didn't use them.
Yeah. And just here for the record, we should note that General Hayden is now the head of the CIA.
That's right. He with the Bush administration, the worse you do, the higher the promotions. So, after blowing it at the NSA, I guess in payback for doing the doing the warrantless eavesdropping operation, he was made deputy head of the office of the Director of National Intelligence, and then from there he was promoted to head of the CIA, which I don't know if it's a real promotion since the CIA is much smaller than the NSA is these days, but if you're in intelligence, it's sort of the ultimate goal is to run the CIA.
We have a couple of callers here. We have about 6-7 minutes left. We'll go to Newton, Illinois for the next. This is line 4. Hello.
Yes, I'm kind of curious. It's kind of mind-boggling to me that there's only been 3 books written on the NSA, and you are the only author. I'm just curious how you've got so much of your information, and have you had contacts with the NSA as far as being an employee at one time? Or your whole background, as an historian, I've never ever seen any topic like this. It's such a big organization where there's so few books written on it. I'm curious if you could go into depth about how you got your information and or at least a roundabout discussion about that. Thank you.
Okay.
Sure, yeah. I spent 3 years in the Navy during Vietnam, but just as a lowly enlisted guy stationed in Hawaii. And then after I got out, I went to college and law school on the GI Bill. And I wanted to get into writing, and I was always fascinated by the intelligence community, so there have been lots of books written on the CIA. Nobody had written any books on the NSA, so I thought I'd try that, and I was always pretty good at doing research, both in law school and even before. So I spent about 6 months doing research and found out that despite its reputation for being impenetrable, I was able to get quite a bit of information on NSA by doing a lot of digging, going places where I thought there might be NSA records, by sending Freedom Information Act requests, by finding... there's a whole series of ways that I was able to get information from NSA when I did The Puzzle Palace, my very first book. And part of that, I was able to basically win what amounts to out-of-court settlements against NSA. And as concessions, they gave me tours of the agency. I was able to interview senior officials there. And, they did that through gritted teeth. They didn't want to do it, but they didn't have any other choice. which is a very long story to get into. But the end result was that when the book came out, they threatened me twice with prosecution. Once because one of the documents I had gotten from the Justice Department, which had been released to me by the Attorney General under the Freedom of Information Act, they wanted to reclassify. Justice Department released it, declassified it, and gave it to me. NSA wanted it reclassified as top secret, and I refused to give it back. So I had all this controversy with NSA on my first book, and then I stayed. I thought, well, you know, a few years from now, somebody else is going to write a book on NSA, and lo and behold, nobody did. So 20 years later, my publisher said, or I guess more like, I don't know, 15 years later, my publisher said, you know, nobody else has done a book on NSA. Why don't you do another one? So I did the sequel called Body of Secrets. And that time, NSA had completely changed. And as David had mentioned, they were more willing, a bit more open at that period. So I was able to get in, get more tours of NSA, interview more people, and write this new book. And this time, NSA liked it. So they had a book signing for me at NSA. And now that leads into this new book. I didn't think I was going to do a third book on NSA, and then all of a sudden I found NSA was doing all this illegal eavesdropping. I found that they had really missed the 9/11 detections and so forth. So, you know, that was enough for a third book. So it's sort of by default that I've been doing this. It's not that I set out dedicating my life to writing three books on NSA.
Okay, I hope that provides an answer. We've got one more caller here. I want to get them in while we have time. This is Urbana, line one.
Good morning.
Yes.
Can you tell us overall whether or not the people of the United States and the country as a whole are better served by having an NSA than by not having an NSA? I ask this not as the ends justify the means kind of question. And could you tell us anything specific that the NSA that has done that actually has led to the better security of the American people?
Yeah, sure. Yeah, these are all good questions from your listeners there. excuse me. Yeah, I think the NSA, there needs to be an NSA. The problem is NSA was not designed to go after terrorists. It's just not the... You're putting a square peg in a round hole. This agency was designed to watch the Soviet Union and prevent a surprise attack, a nuclear attack. That's what it was designed for after World War II. That's what it was created to do for the last 50 years. This role is going after terrorists is just not working for NSA. I mean, they missed the first World Trade Center bombing. They missed the attack on the USS Cole. They missed the attack on the U.S. embassies. They missed the 9/11 attack. NSA is designed to watch a foreign country that's not going anywhere and that communicates a great deal. That's the opposite of what the terrorists are. The terrorists are people that are in New Delhi one day and Kenya the next day. And they communicate very differently. When NSA focused on the Soviet Union, the Soviets always communicated on dedicated lines. These were lines that the Army would use certain channels, the Navy would use certain channels, the diplomats would use certain channels, and NSA specialized in intercepting that communication. The terrorists use anything. You know, they'll use a prepaid calling card on a throwaway cell phone or a pay phone. I mean, these are almost impossible to pick out. Not only that, NSA is huge. It's got the largest collection of supercomputers for code breaking, which was fine if you're attacking a sophisticated encryption system. But for somebody who's just making up codes, like next week is the wedding, I hope everybody shows up. You know, is next week really a wedding, or is that a code for a bombing that's going to take place? So you have all these problems that NSA never faced before. It's not really designed to do this, and it has not a very good track record. I interviewed two of the people who, you know, were intercept operators at the principal listening post for the Middle East, and they were saying that the whole time they were there, which covers almost the whole time from 9/11 to 2007, they never found anybody that spoke Pashtun, which is the key language of the Taliban. So if you're going to war with Afghanistan and they speak Pashtun, it's not very good if the agency that's designed to eavesdrop on these communications doesn't have anybody that understands it. So these are all the problems facing NSA. I think NSA is necessary, but, you know, you got to accept that this is a very different world than it was during the Cold War, and NSA is not the perfect agency to do this. And whether it ever will be, I really don't know.
And in the meantime, they seem to be amassing more information, more raw data on all of us than has ever been collected by one agency or one entity in one place at one time ever.
Well, and that's the danger. You know, since they're not able to do the job, they keep scrambling to find newer ways, and the problem is the newer ways are less productive than the older ways. What the intercept operators that I interviewed told me was that by expanding the huge bowl of communications that they're pulling in, by pulling in all these useless communications of Americans, and what we're talking about are soldiers talking to their wives and people sitting in the state of Georgia, where the main listening post is for the Middle East, you know, just south of the South Carolina border. They're listening to people, soldiers, journalists, aid workers, and so forth in the Middle East, talking to their families back home and having talks about finances, sexual conversations, and they're recording those, transcribing them, laughing about them, and storing them. And they became whistleblowers, which is very rare for NSA, because they thought all that was wrong and they shouldn't be doing it. So it's really a mess. The 9/11 Commission never bothered looking into NSA. The Congress has been bullied into giving them more powers than they need and that they should have. And I think they need another 9/11, or rather another church-type investigation.
Yeah, we're going to have to. We're going to have to leave it there. Pardon me for interrupting you, Mr. Banford. We just have to quit because I'm here at the end of the time. The new book is The Shadow Factory by James Bamford. It is published by Doubleday. Mr. Bamford, thanks very much.
Thanks, David. Great calls.